ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good evening and welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, as the Liberals gear up for the Farah by-election, it's been revealed the results of the party's review of its disastrous 2025 election campaign won't be made public. Also, Tasmania's Treasury warns the state is going broke, and the Matildas prepare to take on the Philippines in the Women's Asian Cup.
I would love to see the Matildas win the Asian Cup. And I think they're ready, and I think it's time that they're able to put another piece of silverware in the cabinet.
Two weeks after being ousted as Liberal leader, Susan Lee has handed in her resignation letter. That formality triggers preparations for a by-election in the regional New South Wales seat of Farah, which Ms Lee held for 25 years. The vote will be the first electoral test for the Liberals since Angus Taylor took the helm of the Federal Party. As campaign teams start preparing for the key poll, it's been revealed the findings of the Liberal Party's review of its disastrous 2025 election result won't be made public. Oliver Gordon reports.
Susan Lee has opted against coming back to Parliament next week to deliver her valedictory speech, saying in a statement, her efforts and achievements speak for themselves.
Her work ethic has been relentless, and we all thank her for the contribution she has made.
Today, Angus Taylor, the man who deposed her as Liberal leader, thanked Ms Lee for her service.
As the member for Farah, and of course, as someone who was a minister in four different governments, and she also played an important role taking on the leadership of the party, as she did after the 2025 election, which was a devastating election for the Liberal Party.
When Susan Lee was elected member for Farah in 2001, John Howard was Prime Minister, and the Coalition's primary vote sat at around 43%. Polls suggest it's now less than half that, lagging behind the anti-immigration protest party, One Nation. One Nation leader Pauline Hanson says more than 80 people have come forward, hoping to represent the party in the upcoming Farah by-election. Today, the field to represent that party has been narrowed to three local business people. The Nationals, Liberals and an independent candidate are also expected to round out what's shaping up to be a four-cornered contest for the seat. The Liberal Party is yet to name its candidate, but has today reportedly opted not to release a review into its disastrous result at the last federal election, against the wishes of some Liberal Party MPs.
Well, it's not the Epstein files. It's not something that the public is entitled to, and I don't think it's something that the Liberal Party should be sharing.
Tony Barry is a director at Redbridge and a former strategist for the Liberal Party.
The Liberal Party had an election review. It was last year on May the 3rd, and they got 31.8% primary vote. So that's the review. That's the result. And what it tells us is that going to an election with a higher taxing agenda and a bigger deficit narrative is not going to win.
We've got the Farah by-election coming up. Do you think not releasing this review publicly sends the wrong message to people who are on the fence about voting for the Liberal Party?
No, I think what they really want to see rather than a review and internal navel-gazing is their vision and policies for a better Australia and how they're going to make their lives better.
One Nation has been flooded with people trying to run in the seat of Farah. In order for the Liberal Party to defeat One Nation, what direction should they go?
Every by-election is different. The problem for the coalition in running in this seat, and presumably Liberal Party and National Party will both field candidates, is that it's a consequence-free by-election. So it doesn't matter how they vote, it's not going to change the government. And that is very dangerous for all parties concerned, particularly the coalition. Their primary vote last time was under 45%. That's always dangerous. With additional candidates in the field, I think it's going to be incredibly difficult for the coalition to win.
As candidates start sketching out their campaign strategies, they'll be keeping an extra close eye on security. This week, the Prime Minister was evacuated from the lodge over a security threat. And last night, a white supremacist gatecrashed a community event hosted by Goldstein MP Tim Wilson in Melbourne. Shouting his views about immigration violently as the mostly elderly crowd looked on. It's the third time the Shadow Treasurer has been confronted by the activist, and police are now investigating. The Farah by-election is set to be held in the coming months.
Oliver Gordon reporting. Hundreds of people from across the Northern Territory have held a noisy but peaceful protest at Parliament House in Darwin today as the new administrator, David Connolly, was sworn in. Earlier social media comments of the Crown's new representative in the NT have offended wide sections of the community. They included posts mocking Indigenous people as well as his views on rape and domestic violence. The protesters confronted the police as an Indigenous elder was arrested when he stepped onto the lawn in front of the Parliament. Our reporter Jane Barden was there.
Not my administrator!
Hundreds gathered in a park beside the NT Parliament to express their anger about the appointment of the NT's new administrator, David Connolly. Among them was Darwin Indigenous Youth Justice campaigner Natalie Hunter.
The horrendous derogatory remarks against women. Shame, absolutely shame. I'm a female and I find it absolutely disgusting, racist.
Federal Indigenous Affairs Minister Mulindiri McCarthy joined the protesters.
The comments that have been made on social media that we've seen are just absolutely deplorable.
David Connolly outraged many with a string of social media posts mocking Indigenous culture, domestic violence, gay sex and using the drug Rohypnol for rape. On Wednesday, he issued a statement that he was genuinely sorry and the posts were not a reflection of his core values. It hasn't been enough to quell community anger, Garawa Indigenous resident Gadrian Hussein.
In the past, he'd been very racial to a lot of Aboriginal people, and he's not a good person to be in as an administrator for the Northern Territory.
Hi, my name's Deb. I think this man is a really poor choice for an administrator. His disrespect for many sectors of our community, particularly women.
I'm Vaughan Williams. I think it's a disgrace. How can we have a racist administrator, a sexist administrator? How can we have someone who makes a joke about domestic violence?
Federal Labor MP Marion Scrimger.
This is a disgrace. It's made a mockery of the Northern Territory. We've got to stop portraying to the rest of Australia that the Northern Territory is cowboy country.
Protest speakers included Darwin Larrakia traditional owner and elder Eric Fijo.
Accountability! Accountability! Where is it?
Shame!
They got no shame because yous know the rest.
Mr. Fijo then stepped over a police string cordon, asserting a Larrakia right to stand anywhere. Police grabbed him and dragged him away to a car to protests from the crowd. Protesters surged around the police car and lay in front of it on the road. But officers drove Mr. Fijo away after accusing him of trespass. The crowd erupted as David Connolly's car arrived to Parliament. As Mr. Connolly and the Governor-General mounted the steps, MPs Marion Scrimger and Selena Yubo stood at the head of the protest as dozens faced off with police lining the cordon. Inside the Parliament, David Connolly started his acceptance speech as administrator in Larrakia language.
Darandira Meningwa Batchua, which means good morning everyone, or it could mean anything the way I just said it.
He committed to serve for the whole community.
This land has a way of keeping people honest, and I intend to be guided by that. I am also conscious that my appointment has prompted a variety of strong views. Well, that's part of a healthy democracy. Debate, difference, and scrutiny are signs of an engaged society. And I commit to responding not with division, but with respect.
Outside protesters, including Justice campaigner Natalie Hunter, said they'll continue to appeal to the NT and federal governments to overturn David Connolly's appointment.
I don't think he's welcome anywhere. I don't know how he's going to do his job.
Your new independent NT MP Yinye Gula said seeing the Larrakia elder being dragged away has increased the community's anger.
This is the landowner. This is the person that owns this country. The government should have listened at least. You're walking all over us. You need to step back. This Westminster system government is just appalling and it doesn't work for us.
That's Yolngu Independent MP Yinya Gyula talking to Jane Bardon in Darwin. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on ABC Listen. Ahead, a dire warning about the Tasmanian economy. The International Medical Aid Organisation, MSF, or Doctors Without Borders, is warning the humanitarian crisis in Gaza is set to worsen, with its international staff leaving the occupied Palestinian territories this weekend. MSF says their departure is being forced by the refusal of Israeli authorities to re-register the organisation because it won't hand over the names of its staff and their biodata, things like fingerprints. MSF says 36 other aid organisations operating in Palestine are in the same position. Tom Roth is the executive director of MSF in Australia and New Zealand, and I asked him why the organisation won't hand over the information requested by the Israeli authorities so it can keep operating in Gaza and the West Bank.
We have been discussing with the Israeli authorities what they require to register ourselves. It is important for us that we safeguard our staff and our patients. And as part of that, we've been discussing with the Israeli authorities what they need that data for. And they have not been able to provide us with assurances on how that data will be used and how we can safeguard our staff.
What effect will the departure of MSF international staff have on the organisation's operations in Gaza and the West Bank?
I mean, as you know, it's a catastrophic situation in Palestine. 80% of the buildings have been destroyed, the healthcare system's destroyed, there's a lack of safe drinking water, and MSF has been providing 1 in 5 hospital beds, 30% of safe deliveries, and a significant proportion of safe drinking water. So obviously, we're deeply concerned if that would be reduced and there's actual need for greater support. The challenge we have is obviously we are registered with the Palestinian authorities. 80% of our staff are Palestinian, and we will continue to provide humanitarian assistance as long as we can, but without the assurance from the Israeli authorities and that ability to bring staff and supplies in, that restricts our ability to provide that humanitarian assistance. We're also deeply concerned that if you remove the international staff from Gaza, you are taking out witnesses to what's occurring and the impact on ground of that conflict, especially in a context where over time we've had journalists, international journalists, are not allowed into Gaza, and also you're seeing the killing of Palestinian journalists. So I think that protection layer is a critical component of international humanitarian assistance.
So what sort of cases are you treating there most often in Gaza at the moment?
So we are providing everything from primary healthcare, safe drinking water. We are a significant supplier of emergency care, surgical support, mental health services. Palestine still has a significant amount of violence, so we're seeing a lot of daily death and injury to violence. So we're treating those that are able to get to our healthcare facilities, but we're also providing that safe obstetric care, so cesarean sections.
So Mr. Roth, the Palestinian staff can stay in Gaza and the West Bank. How will they operate now? Will they have some sort of contact with your international staff, and where will they be?
So at the moment we have our international staff based out of the region, providing support to our Palestinian colleagues. And obviously the Palestinian colleagues live and this is their home. So they will continue to provide that care. We've been working in Palestine since 1988. So we have a long history of providing medical care, mental health care in Gaza. And we will continue to try and be able to provide that care in Palestine for as long as possible.
What's your understanding of why the Israeli government isn't letting enough aid in?
We think that there is a concerted effort to restrict humanitarian assistance. We think the demands around providing those lists are a part and parcel of an attempt to restrict the level of assistance going into Gaza. And that is deeply concerning, not only in the Gaza context, but in a global context of the increasing constrained environments that we are seeing in humanitarian disasters and how we can operate. So it's cognizant on all our governments to make sure that we are pushing and ensuring that all means are put in place to ensure that unhindered access to humanitarian assistance.
What are you calling on the Australian government to do?
We would expect the Australian government, like the rest of the international community, to abide by international humanitarian norms and to demand that of the Israeli government.
Tom Roth is the Executive Director of MSF, that's Doctors Without Borders, in Australia and New Zealand. And PM has approached Israel's Australian Embassy for comment. A spokesperson for the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade told us that the Australian government has, quote, consistently advocated for unimpeded and sustainable humanitarian aid to Gaza. Well, Tasmania is going broke and the situation is worsening rapidly. That dramatic warning is made in a new report from the state's Treasury Department. In fact, the department says the state's financial position is so dire that without drastic changes, Tassie might one day need a Commonwealth bailout. Alexandra Humphreys has more.
Tasmania's Treasury Department is sounding the alarm. In a new bombshell report, it's declared the state's financial position is unsustainable and on track to rapidly deteriorate. Saul Eslake is an independent economist.
I think it is really sending a very clear message to the government and to other members of Tasmania's parliament that you can't just keep kicking this can down the road.
Treasury's five-yearly fiscal sustainability report warns action is needed immediately to address Tasmania's structural deficit. Waiting too long could see interest payments rise so high that repairing the budget would become, quote, exceedingly difficult. The report says debt could climb to $146 billion by 2040, and just servicing that debt could eat up more than 50% of Tasmania's revenue.
If things continued as they have done over the past 10 years, the report suggests that by 2039-40, which is only 13 years away, the Tasmanian public sector could owe the equivalent of about $225,000 for every Tasmanian. That's mind-boggling.
Saul Eslake believes Tasmanians should be worried.
They should be concerned that this has been allowed to fester for at least 6 years since Treasury first started warning about these trends.
The Treasury report shows Tasmania's financial buffers have been depleted, the state is poorly positioned to respond to economic shocks, and more credit rating downgrades are likely, which will further increase the cost of borrowing. It says economic growth alone won't be enough to solve the problem and suggests that ultimately the Commonwealth may need to step in. Robert Hortle is the Deputy Director of the Tasmanian Policy Exchange at the University of Tasmania.
One of the striking things about the report is that Treasury gives examples of places like Puerto Rico and Greece as well, where the government has had to be bailed out by a higher authority. And they really hammer home that that process is typically pretty brutal because the intervening body imposes all these austerity measures.
He argues that Treasury's intended message is clear.
What they're really saying is, look, Tassie, let's not wait until the Australian government has to step in, because if they do, then we as Tasmania are going to lose a lot of control of some of the big decisions around our finances.
Whichever way you look at it, Tasmanians are going to feel the pain of this.
Dean Winter is Tasmania's shadow treasurer.
The Liberals are going to have to cut massive amounts from our health and education systems. They are going to have to raise taxes.
The Tasmanian government says it's been burdened by financial shocks resulting from the COVID pandemic 6 years ago. Felix Ellis is a Tasmanian government minister.
We're the government that had to help steward our community through COVID, and
That's exactly the investment that our community sought from us.
The report comes just months after Tasmania's parliament voted to approve a controversial $1 billion stadium at Macquarie Point in Hobart to secure the Devils AFL team, and after it signed up to the multi-billion dollar Marinus Link undersea cable project.
We're also investing for the future. Big state and nation building projects happening right here in Tasmania that will provide prosperity for generations to come. So, of course, we'll work through the fiscal sustainability requirements for our budget.
Tasmania's next state budget will be handed down in May.
Alexandra Humphreys reporting from Hobart. Australia's women's soccer team is about to begin its Asian Cup campaign. The Matildas play the Philippines in Perth on Sunday. They enjoyed a surge of support during the 2023 World Cup when they made it to the semi-finals. Now hopes are high they can win the Asian Cup, especially with the competition being played on home soil. And as David Sparks reports, there's also growing interest in the team's new, more attacking style of play.
Ford takes the ball in towards the edge of the box. One-on-one with the keeper. Ford slides it home!
The Matildas captured the country's imagination in 2023, going on an unforgettable run through the World Cup.
Gets a turn, he's going to score. Rezo can! And Rezo can score! It's his second goal for Australia!
Now they have the home advantage in another major tournament, the Asian Cup. They've already won it once, back in 2010. What's got many fans excited about the 2026 tournament is the style of football the Matildas have been playing since Joe Montemurro took over as coach less than a year ago. ABC football commentator Ned Hall says he brings a different approach to his predecessor, Tony Gustavsson.
Joe Montemurro seems a lot happier to rotate players around, play them in different positions, and keep things a lot more fluid as well in the way that they play. I called a game in Gosford against New Zealand where the Matildas won by 5-0, and we saw Katrina Gorry and Kyra Cooney Cross surging forward from midfield in a way that they just didn't seem to do under Tony Gustavsson. So I think they're going to play a more exciting attacking brand of football.
The Matildas' first game is in Perth on Sunday night against the Philippines. The squad includes names that Australians have gotten to know well, like the captain Sam Kerr, goalkeeper Mackenzie Arnold, and Mary Fowler, who's coming back from a knee injury. Mackenzie Arnold was one of the heroes in the World Cup 2 years ago. She says the standard at the Asian Cup keeps on rising.
I think the level of competition in every federation has risen. Women's football globally is getting better and better each year. I think looking back on the Philippines game a couple of years ago, there's a different coach, there's a whole different playing style. So we definitely look on that, but at the same time, we have to also adapt to how we play now.
Samka shoots right-footed. What a strike! What a goal!
As always, there's as much interest on the impact the Matildas have off the pitch as on it. Kerry Harris is the chair of Women on Side, and she focuses on administration in football, including leadership and governance.
We know that the Matildas are a favoured team in Australia. You had a look at the Women's World Cup in 2023 at that semi-final. Over 11 million people watched it on broadcast. So we have high visibility for the sport in Australia. What I'm interested in is that visibility translating into the boardroom and the club rooms around Australia.
And what's your answer?
We produce some data every year. We call it the Women on Side Index. We're interested in tracking the 40-40-20 rule in the governance structure in Australia. What that means is 40-40-20 is 40% representation of men, 40% representation of women, and 20% other. We've just done that analysis, and I'm disappointed to say that only 6 out of our 11 major governing bodies are meeting that standard at the moment.
What are you hoping is achieved or happens in this Asian Cup?
Firstly, I would love to see the Matildas win the Asian Cup. They won it back in 2010, and I think to have it here in Australia and to win it would be just remarkable, and I think they're ready. After that, how do we keep that momentum going? Because we have seen that momentum drop off from the World Cup.
Kerry Hall says when the Matildas are going well, the country takes notice.
When we are winning and everyone is feeling euphoric about it, then I think that translates, more broadly into society. I think what happened from post the World Cup is that not only did women's football in Australia win, so did women's sport more broadly. because we were able to show what is possible. And recently I heard this fabulous quote from former Matilda Renee Isariff: what we make visible shapes what other people believe is possible. That's the important message there, is visibility.
The Matildas' three group stage games are against the Philippines, Iran and Korea.
David Sparks reporting. And that's PM for this week. PM is produced by John Stewart and Alison Shaw. Technical production by Nick Drakoulis and Joram Toth. I'm Samantha Donovan. Just a reminder, the podcast of the program is available on ABC Listen. And we'll be back on Monday evening. I hope you have a great weekend. Good night.
Hey, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Bill and Hillary Clinton are being hauled before a US House committee investigating the late convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Today, David Smith from the United States Studies Centre at Sydney Uni on what we can expect from their depositions. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on ABC Listen.